corn, and TVs.
To a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Hello, William Biggs, and hello, everyone watching. This is the Zero Books podcast and live stream. We're going to be talking today about socialism, and I'll introduce William. The bio I have for you here is William Briggs has been variously a teacher, a journalist, and a political activist. He is a regular contributor to the blog and newsletter Pearls and Irritations, and he is the author of three books, two of which are coming out or have been published by Zero Books, and those are Removing the Stalinist Stain and A Cauldron of Anxiety. So, William, welcome to the podcast and live stream and to our audience commenters.
Thanks very much.
So, you know, I wanted to start actually by throwing you off with a question about your second book with us, A Cauldron of Anxiety. Do you think that the psychological maladies that the masses are suffering under are limiting our ability, workers' abilities to organize politically?
Undoubtedly. Part of the idea behind the book was to look at Marx and alienation and then just translate that a little bit to a broader setting, and that is everything that is surrounding us. The fact that an awful lot of us, perhaps the majority of us these days, aren't getting a decent night's sleep. And why? And the why ends up being the way society is structured, the way capitalism works, and the disparity between the working class, which has been denied by so many, and the way that the ruling class rules. The fact that in every aspect of our life, we're finding more and more stress, more and more anxiety, more and more disconnectedness from each other, from groups, from large groups, small groups. The fact that society has been effectively atomized in the last 30 years or so. The fact that we still live in this tightly fixated national bubbles, whereas capitalism has intensely globalized, so that we are confronting, when we attempt to confront issues, we are locked into a national response to what are almost exclusively global problems. The fact that a worker in the United States or Britain or Australia or anywhere else is connected unconsciously, I suppose, to each other and not to those same forces that keep on promoting the idea that, look, we're all in this together, we have same interests. If you're on the factory line, you allegedly got the same interests as the factory manager or the owner, but you've got very little to do with a connection to a Chinese worker or an American one if I'm in Australia. So all of this has moved over time into a situation where we just don't know who we are, where we are, what's going on. We've got very few people to turn to. In earlier times, we had the connections of groups within society. We were joiners. Political party memberships have declined, whether they be left or right. Social organisations spoke to us and for us. Trade unions, social democratic parties, communist parties have all been victims of this. The trade unions and social democratic parties have become increasingly legitimized over the decades. That has led to a co-opting by the state of those organizations that are supposed to and were constructed to act in and on the workers' behalf. So these are the reasons why I've thought about this book, that it promotes the idea that we are and have been atomized and isolated and that it is driving us slowly, or not so slowly, mad. And the only way out of madness is organization and do something about it. A self-help book, if you like.
Yeah. Well, you know, it strikes me that there's two sides to our dilemma. And on the one hand, you started out by saying that one of our problems is that we are still ideologically maybe focused around the local and the provincial or the national, whereas the system that we're working within, the material system of production and distribution, is truly international. Now, it has been for a while. I mean, we've been living in an international system of capitalism for, you know, over 100 years. I would say that would not be a stretch to say that, probably over 200. However, it seems to me that perhaps, and let me ask you, just because I'm not sure, do you think that, let's say, in the 1930s or 1940s, or even as close to us as in the 90s, that people were more connected to the mode of production that provided them with what they needed? In other words, things were more likely to be produced locally. They would see a connection between their own work and what was happening in their community, and that that internationalism is intensified on the level of like the basket of commodities that you need to reproduce the workers. In other words, the consumer side of the economy has internationalized more, and that has something to do with our atomization, that we can't see any connection between our work and our communities anymore. Is that the problem?
It's certainly central to the problem. You're absolutely right to suggest that capitalism has been globalizing since capitalism first took its first breath. It can't do anything but globalize, because to do otherwise signifies imminent death for it, because it has to be a growing, expanding organism. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, capitalism was largely nationally based. Capital established enterprises on a national basis. Workers moved to where production was. This involved immigration for many, many people. A country like my own, Australia, was absolutely dependent upon this immigration for where capital was. What's happened, of course, with the intensification of globalization is that capital has moved to where a labor force is. This has meant, obviously, a destruction of manufacturing industries in so many developed Western economies, and with that, the intensification of this form of alienation, because you're quite right, the worker was closely linked to that mode of production. If you're building refrigerators in the factory, you're probably going to be consuming those refrigerators, even though they were highly protected industries. The prices were obviously inflated because of that. But there was a sense of common ownership, even though that sense was incorrect, I believe, which is part of what I describe as a fog of ideology, where we are convinced that our interests are similar across classes in society. So why this happened, why this intensification of capitalist globalization, of course, kicks in from the 70s and an ongoing crisis that is always threatening capital, and that is the potential for the rate of profit to fall. And it started to fall fairly significantly. So capital was forced to break those national bounds even more obviously, which then compelled nation states to react to that, because part of the deal with them, of course, is to promote the idea of oneness, of usness, of nationness in the face of some fairly significant contradictions. We've got to maintain a sense of order and a sense of purpose. And that becomes more increasingly difficult, intensely more difficult, when you are divorced from that production. And that's certainly the case. I mean, when we talk about global production chains, we can go and buy a motor car today, tomorrow. I own a Ford car. It was ostensibly a product of an Australian factory, although it was produced in probably 15 or 20 separate factories in 15 or 20 separate countries. So that sense of unity has absolutely shattered, and in so doing has created this sense of bewilderment.
Yeah. Do you think that if we were to achieve a socialist form of society that we would still have products like this, which are built in various factories and you know, where the idea comes in one country and the parts come from around the world? If the working class were to liberate itself from exploitation, that we'd still want to hold on to the way the world cooperates to build new commodities? Or do you think that there would be a return to a more kind of local communal form of life under a socialist society?
Both of those things actually happen, and they're not mutually exclusive. Production and consumption would become even more global. Capitalism is a form economic formation which is an advance on that which went before. Nobody in their right mind would suggest that feudalism had anything going for it in comparison to capitalism. So too with socialism. Socialism, if it is to succeed, and when it succeeds, it will be an advance on the capitalist mode of production. And that, by definition, will make it even more global and globalized than it is today, because socialism cannot be sustained within a national framework. It needs and must be part of a global entity, thereby also meaning that production will be global. There's a potential, therefore, an actual global planned economy based on need rather than whim. Now, the Rubik's Cube that you have there, and I'm sure you're very good at it, there's no reason on this earth why that shouldn't be continued to be produced. We also mentioned about the localized and the communal aspect of things. That does not get diminished under a global socialism, because we still live in community. We still live in local communities. What gets taken out of that is the level of exploitation and therefore the atomization that goes with that. We have the power to consume the products that we have had a role in producing. So that car that I just mentioned, it matters not to anybody whether the factory exists in my country ever again. We've got access to it. What we can do is we can produce those things which are globally useful, or parts thereof. It doesn't have to be in any way linked to a national mode of production, because those things cannot sustain themselves. So there's no contradiction between globalization and a lack of anxiety of the worker. In fact, given a rational society, those two things actually improve each other. Doesn't make sense, but you know what I mean. I can't hear you, though.
Ah, unmute myself. I want to talk to you about the book that's coming out next month, The Stalin Stain, or Removing the Stalin Stain. I guess what I to shift over to that is that book and the questions in that book, or the issues in that book. I want to just start by asking how the Soviet Union became, in your estimation, an intensely anti-Marxist state? And maybe offer a follow-up question to that right away, which is, what core ideas in Marx do you think Stalin or Stalinism opposed?
If I appear to be getting off the track, bring me back, won't you?
Because yeah.
It may easily happen. But by the same token, don't leave the Rubik's Cube alone.
I'm just messing it up. I'm not trying to solve it. I'm sure
you can within milliseconds.
Well, we're going to test that at the end, I guess. I'll see how fast I can do it. And you'll see it'll be 10 minutes, and then you'll be very disappointed. No, we won't do that. But
Righto. So the anti-Marxism of Stalinism. Marxism, from its first moment, was international. It perceived capitalism as an internationalizing force, and it perceived the struggle against that to be international. Marx and Engels, Lenin, Trotsky could not conceive of socialism being constructed in a single country. It couldn't be, because they were dealing with a global entity. So socialism was designed to replace capitalism globally. That slogan of Marx, which has been used and changed and made more or less politically correct as the time goes by, but a new version of it, the working people have no country, was they meant it. They meant it, that those links were international. Now, what happens is, Soviet Union, born of revolution, born of socialist revolution, is confronted with a dilemma. The dilemma is of their own making, or particularly of Stalin's making. There are so many opportunities for the Soviet Union to fulfill its role, and that is to be a springboard for a socialist revolution, both internally and externally. But when you think about the disasters that befell the world and working class of the world in the years following Stalin, Germany, Britain, France, China, Spain, the capacity for Hitler to rise are all products of Stalin's idea. And I know that people are immediately going to say, hey, how can you say that? He's Georgian. But great Russian nationalism was the motivating force for Stalin. We've got to accommodate the world working class movement, the world communist movement, to the defense of the Soviet Union, regardless of whatever that might mean. So the dilemma for Stalinism was that it was quickly found to be neither fish nor fowl, if you like. It wasn't capitalist, clearly. It couldn't be socialist, obviously. So it's caught in this midstream, which the very best you can possibly describe it as, is a bureaucratized state or a degenerated worker state. It remained a worker state, absolutely. There was no capitalist ruling class emerging. There was a bureaucratic caste. But none of this has anything to do with Marx's vision of the future. Now, I don't think it's enough or good enough or acceptable to say, oh, this is what we were stuck with. We had to make the best we could of it. And they did make the best they could of it, I suppose. Living standards rose, produced many things that were very, very good for the people. But it didn't go anywhere near replacing or improving upon the capitalism that it was supposed to be fighting against.
Okay, can I just interject here? And absolutely. You said a moment ago that it couldn't have been capitalist, but then you just said it didn't really replace the capitalism that it was supposed to be transcending. It also struggled, I think, to fully embrace capitalism and get beyond the feudal or peasant-based society at first. But it did industrialize, and there was a kind of, I would say, what do you think of the Johnson Forest tendency and others who would claim that the capitalist, the Soviet Union was a state capitalist formation, that well, the property relations changed, and that is, you know, there was no private class of capitalism, of capitalists who would own the means of production for their own private profit. But nonetheless, a surplus was created for a group of bureaucrats that they administered, you know, administrated, and they worked to distribute, not for their own private consumption, but nonetheless, there was a surplus extracted from the working class. At the foundational level, it was a capitalist state. What would you make of that kind of argument?
I would reject it, to be perfectly
honest. Yeah, well, on what basis?
And on what basis?
Yeah.
The fact that state capitalism, the term comes from an expression that was based on the ability of a capitalist state and a capitalist structure to take control of sections, large sections of production. Now, there's a bit of a riddle or a conundrum appears when we talk about the Soviet Union. And my thinking comes from Trotskyism. And if I can sort of paraphrase Trotsky a little bit here, no, I won't paraphrase him, I'll just try and cut to the chase a little bit. The conundrum is that if state capitalism comes into being when a bourgeois state assumes control of the capitalist economic structures, how then can a state that is clearly not bourgeois, that does not have those capitalist functions, how can it assume control of capitalism from private capitalists, which denotes state capitalism, where none actually exist? State capitalism is an argument that is logical and it's comfortable and it seems to fairly happily resolve the question. It's neither this nor that, so therefore it has to be something in the middle. Early Trotskyists were among those who kicked this problem off when they were having one of their interminable splits from Trotsky, when Trotsky was still alive. How do you define the Soviet Union? Which is why that definition of a degenerated worker state came into being. It was not capitalist. It could not have been capitalist. Okay, there was surplus was being produced and surplus was being used and surplus may and being expropriated. What the Soviet Union was left with was a choice. And if it were state capitalist, that choice need not have been had to be made. And the choice was whether it should become a capitalist state, thereby getting rid of the concept of the worker state altogether, or whether it could somehow recreate its social beginnings and clean up its act, if you like, become a worker state again. Now, if it was state capitalist, those choices are removed. In fact, what happened was it took many, many, many years, several decades, for the choice to finally be made, and it was made for them through economic crisis. The choice was that the Politburo, the Central Committee, will close our folds or pick up our hats and our coats and we'll just walk away and become the capitalist class that they did become. The fact that they didn't do that through all of those years would indicate that it was not consciously facing the question of what will we become. State capitalism is already a becoming and already an existence. And if that were the case, we would see evidence of all those other trappings of capitalism that go along, not just privilege for a bureaucratic class or caste, sorry, but you would start to see all those other symbols of capitalism that appear even in state capitalist enterprise or entities. People use the term examples of places like Singapore as state capitalists, and yeah, maybe that's closer to the fact. But where were the stock markets? Where were the outward signs of capitalist exploitation? These things weren't there, but they are there now because it has transformed itself into, has made the choice, an unfortunate choice, but a choice that was coming for a long time. That probably doesn't resolve the issue satisfactorily, but...
you haven't convinced me, but... you've laid out your side of the argument, and this is a neat thing about being a Marxist, is we can find long-standing points of disagreement, and if we want, we can split over it, or run campaigns to denigrate one another. But I don't have the desire to do that. So what I will say is that I think that on the level of what constitutes a bourgeois state, that changes over time. I mean, Mao had his understanding of a bourgeois state as a state with multiple parties and a parliamentary system rather than a communist party that represented the interests of the workers more directly and was more directly connected to the community. I'm sure Stalin had his understanding of what constitutes a bourgeois state as well. Obviously, the question of how capitalism works without competition between capitalists to innovate production through a process of competition over profits is a vexing one for people who would want to claim that the Soviet Union was state capitalist. What I would say is that the economic crisis shows what happens in a system where you don't have that kind of market competition and capitalist formation in the background there is competition, but on between states, and that the economic crisis in the Soviet Union demonstrated the inefficiencies of planning. Say that would be an argument I could at least begin to make. But I think what I would rather do is ask about how you think there's two questions. One is, how is it that we can look to the Soviet Union and what happened there and hold on to Marxism? And there's a thinker from the 60s, a Greek-French theorist named Cornelius Castoriadis, who abandoned Marxism as he deepened his critique of Bolshevism in the Soviet Union, and I kind of want to know how people hold on to it, and also because I'd like to, I'm trying to hold on to it myself, because I think it's true, the critique of society, but also how did do you think that there needs to be a kind of return to a Marxism that was around before the Soviet Union or before the Bolshevik Revolution? Mm. That would be my other question.
Sure. The business of holding on to Marxism is fairly simple, I find it, because ultimately we've got two ideas, and Marxism is one of them. And for me, it's a simple choice. You can choose Marxism and hope, or anti-Marxism and a lack of hope and depression. That's fairly simplistic. The Castoriadis idea, he represents one of so many Marxists and ex-Marxists who, coming from Stalin's deformation of things, was set to work to try and fix it. What's wrong with Marxism? Is something hasn't worked out. There must be some problem that we can resolve. And in the seeking to resolve the problem, you can't but almost inevitably move further from the center, from the core. And those central elements of Marxism, of accepting that there is a revolutionary potential to the working class, that the working class is the largest and overwhelmingly largest force in society, the fact that exploitation exists, the fact that classes exist, the fact that the only way to resolve these issues is through revolutionary struggle. These things are optimistic ideas. What happened when faced with the dilemma of something has gone wrong? A feeling of despair can easily overwhelm people. And it certainly did. And you can understand why. A whole life experience and expectation gets turned on its head when things go so terribly astray. So discovering or rediscovering those core elements of Marxism aren't that tricky, because if you return to Marx and not what people have written about Marx, is to return to a lucidity, an articulation that is so accessible. The message is so beautifully clear. Why? Because Marx was, who was he writing for? He wasn't writing to bedazzle another group of academics. He wasn't writing to put himself on some sort of academic pedestal that would confront and confound opponents. He was writing for ordinary working people, giving them the weapons, the tools to change society, not to interpret it, but to change it, you know, the old slogan. And it's not difficult to return to that sort of an idea. And it's not a difficult idea to get your head around. People have been turning to it ever since Marx wrote his first words. What happens along the way is you get such a convoluted and such a confused idea that you don't know which way to turn. That is made worse by Stalin on one side, trying to explain a distorted version of Marxism that has nothing to do with reality, and on the other hand, by the bourgeois state, whose task it is to keep us all in this fog of confusion. So returning to Marx is an absolute essential, and not a difficult one. It means breaking from organizational structures, if you like, that are linked and tied to the state itself. It's a very tricky thing to get to Rome with, but to suggest that political parties, trade unions, have become over time actually organs of the state. How do you fight the state by the own organs of the state? Very, very, very tricky. But you can see elements of this, microcosmic elements, if you like, and I might be just a necessarily optimistic person, I don't know. But throughout 2019 and even into this year is a mutant sort of year with pandemics and so on, the whole world was in upheaval. And it was a working class upheaval, poorly or not led at all in some cases, but it was leaving aside those official organs of society, issues that were apparently fairly trivial, you know, the bus fare rises by 5 cents, or mobile phone connections change, led suddenly to eruptions of the working class people. In your own country, United States, the wave of strikes that swept that country and still are, that are not necessarily connected to organisations. They are unorganised workers, independently organising workers. Mm-hmm. Okay, small numbers, but they show that there is a possible change in the wind. And that is what Marxism is all about. And it's not difficult to go back to Marx, to look at Marx and say, hey, there is a better way.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And obviously, in the United States right now, the struggle of essential workers who want better conditions during the pandemic is, I think, both inspiring and essential to the worker struggle overall. I think that if there's hope, it is in the hands of those kinds of workers right now. And I need to get Chris Smalls, who is one of the lead organizers for the Amazon workers in the warehouses, back on to the channel. I've been meaning to do that forever. I keep kind of apologizing to him whenever I get him on, because I don't get him on often enough. But what I still worry about a little bit is how clear a vision workers or academics or activists have of how to organize for socialism rather than how to just struggle against the problems of the day or whatever class struggle might arise in the moment around like wages or work conditions. And, you know, I wonder how it could have happened that the aim of overcoming class society has been obscured. And I think it's easy to point to Stalin and blame Stalin for that. He certainly was a part of the problem. But in the United States, maybe the Stalinist communists had some role, but I think that there were a multitude of factors, one of which was the success of the post-war economy. At least that's one of the stories that's told, is that the consumer economy that rose up after World War II placated the working class and made it more difficult to organize for radical struggle. Do you think that's the case? Do you think that consumerism undermines our ability to organize politically for overcoming class?
Certainly it's a factor. Certainly it's a factor. There is probably, if you probably know, one magic wand that can be waved. However, I think that that phrase, the revolutionary potential of the working class, is as valid today as it was when it was first coined. What we don't have is a consistent, theoretically well-armed leadership to make those changes, to make that move from relative spontaneity that this issue in this particular workplace or that particular community or that action over there is wrong and we've got to struggle against it. That is where the problem starts to stem from, that leadership issue. This, and you're right to say that, okay, it's not all the role of the Stalinist parties in capitalism that are behind this. But in that move to try and distance yourself from what is clearly wrong, Stalinism, the non-Stalinist left have made a series of steps, taken a series of steps, and I know that one of the big issues that enveloped your country, my country, all of our states, the idea of identity politics. To me, this is in fact another splintering, hiving off of useful endeavours because of this lack of leadership. Not to suggest any one of those issues isn't seriously important, but if you think about any one single interest, single issue political struggle, it can be 100% successful. 100% successful, capitalism has not been dented one jot. The biggest social group in society is the working class. To split it into black worker, white worker, male worker, female worker, into ethnicities, into all of the things that have happened, into sexual preferencing, whatever, all it does is weaken the overall struggle.
The main thing that we're split into, and you mentioned at the outset, was different national sectors, right? And in the United States, it's not even that we're broken up by nation, but by state or even county. So the geographical and political divisions between the workers are, I think, much more difficult hurdles to overcome than racial boundaries, for instance, or gender boundaries. I don't think we even see those boundaries as boundaries between the workers because they're so strong, maybe. Mm. I'm not sure. But anyhow, go ahead.
Yeah. What you just mentioned just reminded me of something. Australia, as you're probably aware, is made up of 6 separate states. Mm-hmm. If we talk about the movement for socialism in a single country being difficult, in the state of Victoria, where I live, a group of left, notionally Marxist groups, a couple of years ago formed themselves into a separate party or a coalition of parties to fight struggles in Victoria. The name they gave themselves, in fact, is rather interesting, Victorian Socialists. So it's no longer a question of socialism in a single country, within a single state, and possibly even within a couple of suburbs. This sort of encapsulates the problem that we're faced with, as you say, national issues and so on. And whatsoever that sort of thinking goes on, the difficulties become greater. But the prize is fairly important too, so it's well worth struggling for. But it's a political issue, therefore it has to be resolved politically by political organisation. And that needs to be as broad, as wide, as far-reaching as possible. If a Ford worker has more in common with a Ford worker in wherever, in South Africa and so on, than they do in their own country, so too do to workers all over, so too the political thinkers. Who was it? Wallerstein, 1,000 Marxisms.
Mm-hmm.
There really needs to get back to being a Marxism that can actually do the confronting. And that can only be done through political activities, not by, no matter how well-meaning the individual might be or the small group of individuals, that linking of theory and practice. We've got no shortage of theory, but as you say, it often fights against each other. It's the practice, and we got plenty of practice, but the practice is more and more disjointed and dislocated. It's a connecting of those two that is the key.
Maybe they're more connected than we think, and that's why the practice is so disjointed, is because we have 1,000 Marxisms. here, I want to show you something. Look.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah.
You haven't got 2 there, have you?
I have 2. I've got one behind me. So this one, all right. This one is a little, it's just a little harder to turn. I could solve it too, but it would take me a little longer. This one I just got today. I can turn it.
Congratulations.
Yeah. And my son.
Oh, it just goes a step further.
My son Ben, who sometimes is on the podcast with me, has. I sent him a Rubik's Cube for his birthday with the challenge to see which one of us could solve it faster. And he can solve it much more quickly than I can. Of course, solving this is only a matter of memorizing an algorithm. You don't actually have to. I didn't think it through and solve it. I
got unlike the struggle against capitalism, which takes a little bit of thinking through.
Yeah, everyone would like it if we could just read Marx and he would give us the algorithm for.
Absolutely.
For solving
it. Isn't it?
Say it again.
It's called being prescriptive.
Yeah. I would, but no, look, I take it. I take those instructions. And, if I could provide them to people, that would be cool too. So that's my secret goal. I know it's a bad one to try to come up with the algorithm for overcoming capitalism. In my fantasies, that's what I'd like to achieve. Why don't we take a couple of questions from people who are in the comments now, and then wrap it up, and we can do a second, more casual conversation for people who are patrons. Just maybe about how you're feeling today. You can tell me, because I'm a pretty typical ugly American. I'm not following Australian politics very well. I'm very much overwhelmed and dominated by American politics. But you can tell me.
We're all
yeah, I know. It's crazy. I'm so sorry that people around the world have to know about Donald Trump and Joe Biden for that matter. Yeah, let's see if we have the questions here. And if people want to use the super chat and make a contribution to the channel, this is a good time to do that as well. Someone asks, vulgar Marxism, yes or no? What do you think, William?
The question needs to be a little bit bigger than vulgar Marxism. Yes, well, obviously, no, I don't want it to be.
Yeah, right.
It's such a fairly vague sort of question. And is it loaded? Is it going somewhere? Is it, you know, what does it presuppose? I mean,
Here's a question that might be easier to answer. How big of an obstacle are Twitter tankies for creating socialism?
No, in fact, I'm much obliged to you. The first time I came around, it was the first on the show, the first time I discovered this term tankies, and it really did appeal to me. But it's funny, isn't it? They spend so much time pouring so much vitriol on people like yourself. Your biggest fans are those who would see you shut down. What happens if they're successful? I don't know.
I think that's an overstatement. When I think that the people who watch our the Zero Books channel have responded very well. The same people have responded very well. I'm assuming there's two possibilities.
I know.
Yeah, but the people that they've liked some of what I do, but whenever I'm critical of the Soviet Union, there's an onslaught. The other possibility, I think this is even more likely, is that people are stopping by because the internet can direct groups of people to content. So like someone will say, hey, the Zero Books put out a video critiquing Stalinism. Let's all pile on and go over to the video, or let's all go over this live stream. And they're not necessarily the regular audience.
Bring it back to the question. I was being facetious, and I know.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. No, whoever asked the question is it's a very, very obvious and a serious question. Deserves a serious answer, I think. What is astonishing is that despite the fact I'm 67 years old in a few months' time, and I was born in the year that Stalin died, the fact that he has been interred and most of his ideas have sunk with him, I would like to think, the cult of Stalin seems to survive, and in so doing, it is slightly corrupts the idea of Stalin. Because these same tankies so love the idea of the hard man, the strong man, the show me some discipline line, you're able to sweep aside so much that actually got in the way of Marxist development. The fact that they're out there, it does denote, I mean, the other book that we talked about earlier, the anxiety thing, it may even link into that a little bit, that we are living in such a confused, confusing and unenlightened world that will cling to simple answers, simplistic answers. We've got someone who says Stalin was played such a massive role in the war, so therefore Stalin is a great guy. The fact that Stalin's policies allowed Hitler to emerge and gain power gets dismissed. Stalinists can say, oh, look, steel production in the Soviet Union was a colossal victory for socialism. Yeah, but having lived in the Soviet Union and walking on the street when you just managed to buy a new kettle and every person that passes you by says, where did you get that? And you say, oh, six blocks down there, and off they go to buy a kettle whether they need one or not, is a direct response to Stalinism. And yet in the West, Stalin remains and is growing in stature, and in the Soviet Union, or the ex-Soviet Union, sorry, in Russia. You can understand that to a certain degree, I suppose, that nostalgia is a powerful weapon, and things aren't going well, so when were things seemingly better? And in modern age, we've got a system in total tatters and crisis. Wasn't like that when Stalin was around. So, but the Panky is an interesting phenomenon, and best left to dark spaces where they belong.
Well, do you think that it's worthwhile to read Stalin's writings, and even though he may not be the most, I mean, I would say that it's worthwhile when you're studying the history of socialism to read Stalin and to read Mao to see how their thinking influenced policy and to see to what extent they were repeating a Kautskyist orthodox Marxism, mm-hmm. or to and what extent they were diverging from all forms of Marxism. Do you think that's true, that it's worthwhile to not let the Stalin's idea? Yeah, I realized as I was asking the question, it was sort of a false question, because the answer was yes, obviously. But nonetheless, the problem is when people turn to Stalin or Mao as their introduction to Marxism, say, or to socialism, which I think may happen these days. I'm not sure.
If people turn to Stalin as a fundamental reading of Marxism, cannot really see them surviving too well. The simple fact of its difficulty to deconstruct it is a tricky enough thing. To actually read it is so tedious and so hard, such hard work, as opposed to reading Marx, which is simplicity, beauty, and not arid as Stalin's stuff is. However, yes, by all means, people should read it, but as an adjunct, as an add-on. The same way, of course, you have to read Stalin, you have to read Mao if you can call yourself a Marxist, the same way that Wall Street Journal editors, I'm sure, are not totally ignorant of Marx. They quote him often enough.
Yeah, yeah.
Know what you're talking about unless you know what you're talking about.
No. Do you think if the World Revolution would have happened alongside the Russian Revolution, the Soviet Union would have been different?
Absolutely. For starters, the Soviet Union would have been a component part in that world socialist system, not by any means the pivotal, the leading force. I'm two very bad bits of paraphrasing. One from Lenin, who I can't remember the source or where when it was, but he said something along the lines that, yes, we've had this revolution, I would much sooner see the centre of the revolutionary movement move from Moscow to Berlin tomorrow, and if that meant the total destruction of what we've achieved for the benefit of the world revolution, then so be it. The Soviet Union and its struggles that it had to go through to maintain itself all those years would have been an entirely different world had that socialist revolution prevailed. It had a role in making that happen, and it chose not to do that. But the world was ready, and the world is ready. And the Soviet Union would have been an entirely different place, and a place well worth the title.
Last quote from the comments. I had a great night, but it wasn't tonight. Groucho Marx, and I'm wearing a Groucho Marx shirt, so I thought I did that. And then, yeah. Actually, I had a great time talking to you. And what I'd like to do is go ahead and end this stream, and in about 10 minutes, start a second one that will be for patrons only. We have something called the Zero Books Parrot Room. I stole that from a couple of very much centrist political commentators on something called Blogging Heads. It's Robert Wright and Mickey Kaus are the two guys. And I don't agree with them politically at all. I understand they are both class enemies of different types. I probably would send them to a re-education camp after revolution, but I would protect them from the firing squads and the gulag. I enjoy their banter, so I stolen from them. They started something called the Parrot Room, and we're going to be doing it here, the Zero Books Parrot Room, in just a moment. So thanks for – you'll stick around for that, William?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. So I'm going to run the out reel here, which is the same as the in reel, and then we'll say goodbye to each other after the live stream's ended.
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
see them. We still, to a large extent,